Welcome, everyone, to the Comedy Sports Podcast with your host, Christine Rolo Capriolo, and today's special guest, the man who bears no moss, Mike Rolling Rock.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Comedy Sports Podcast. I'm Christine Rolo Capriolo, and I'm very excited to have a super duper special guest today. Everyone, welcome Mike Rock. Hey, Mike, thanks for coming.
Woohoo! I'm super duper special.
You are. I was thinking about you on the way here to Kyle's place. I'm a teacher, and when I first got my job where I am currently in Brookfield, Wisconsin, my first year there, to this day, and I've been there over 20 years now, talked about this one principal, Briscoe. His last name was Briscoe, the mighty Briscoe, and how totally amazing he is, and he's amazing, he's wonderful, and... But, like, everyone just is in awe of him, and that's how I feel about you. Everyone that mentions Mike Rock is like, oh, Mike Rock, and they think he's like, you're this most wonderful, awesome improv person, but I feel like it's been kind of hard to touch base with you, so I'm so glad we got to talk today.
Oh, I am too. That's very flattering, and I hope people aren't mixing me up with Principal Briscoe.
I never met him. Briscoe, I don't know.
Briscoe the kid, I like to call him. And by the way, thanks, Kyle, for engineering today. Christine, I'm so flattered and delighted to be on the Comedy Sports Podcast. It's exciting. It's a Comedy Sports is a gigantic part of my life for so long, and I really love the opportunity to talk about it.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Well, before we get to how I've heard of you, and I think I met you very briefly in Madison, let's begin with where you're from. Where were you born?
I was born at St. Mary's Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin. Born and raised, so that's like where you went to high school and everything?
Yes. It's the only... a city built on an isthmus in North America. An isthmus, for those who don't know, is a landlocked peninsula. It's 90 miles of away from Milwaukee, and just a little piece of joy in the middle of the heartland.
Madison is fabulous. I love Madison. Do you go back there often or not?
I did for many, many years. I moved with a small posse, which we'll get to later, but to New York. I moved very slowly over the course of a couple of years between 1990 and 1992, and then moved to Los Angeles subsequently about 16 years ago. But while my folks were around, I was back in Madison very regularly. I really loved the respite and peacefulness of going back to Madison.
Oh yeah, there's no place like it. I love it and miss it. I was there 5 years, and I wish it was longer. So when you lived in Madison, did you go to college there? Did you study at UW-Madison?
I did. Yeah, I was pre-med and a psych major.
Really?
I
didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't end up going. I should say that any advice that I give today is not that of a doctor. I didn't end up going to medical school.
Okay.
I'm not qualified. I'm absolutely happy to give medical advice if anybody wants it. I just want the disclaimer out there.
Okay, just so you know. Like Bill Murray on SNL about, who was that? Steve Martin. Who's the barber here? You need a good bleeding. You remember that one?
Yes. Who's the barber? The barbers used to do surgery. So
I don't want my barber doing surgery on me. That's for sure.
Right. Especially now in COVID times, you don't want to go into like a hair cutter and have them start slicing off parts of your body. It's just not good.
I mean, I love Al Oldham, but no, I don't want him cutting me up to pieces. So tell me, how did you hear about Comedy Sports then? And how did that become part of your life in Madison?
I was in school. I had been a kid actor in Madison doing Children's Theater of Madison, and I was the kid in a lot of University of Wisconsin productions growing up. And in high school, I got very serious about school and thought I needed to, you know, kind of buckle down and not be an actor. And I of course took every opportunity to do acting without actually auditioning for a play. Like, I was class president and spoke at like grandparents' day and I did all the things that you do when you want to be a performer without actually having to try to get in a play until I was a senior. And then I did the musical and I was like, oh man, I am an actor after all.
It's true.
So then I went to Madison, to the University of Wisconsin. And, I did the same thing again for the first year. I was like, okay, let's buckle down and get serious about school and, sign up for all pre-med classes and all that kind of stuff. And then about two and a half years in, I realized, oh, I want to do a play.
Yeah.
And so I was about to audition for a play that would be happening during the summertime. It was, you know, you audition in the spring and the play happens during summer. But I should interrupt myself to say that while I was still in high school, there was an improv group in Madison, and I'd never seen anything like it. And one of my older brothers was friends with some of the people in the show, and I went to see it, and I said to my performer self when I was 16 or something, I said, oh my God, that's what I want to do. Well, it turns out that group, some of whom subsequently became friends, was Joan Cusack and Holly Wartell and Pam Thompson and Doug Rand and Jeff Kahn and Evan Gore. And they were called the ARC, and they were created by this guy, Dennis Kern, and his then wife, Elaine Eldridge Kern. And they were doing basically Spolin exercises, Spolin games. Mm-hmm. And they had kind of a pipeline to Chicago because Joan was from there and Holly and et cetera. And I just thought it was the greatest thing. And I auditioned for it and didn't get in when I was in high school. Then I auditioned again when I was a freshman in college and didn't get in. And then when I was a junior in college, I was in this summer play, the Front Page. Some people know the movie, His Girl Friday.
Okay.
And a guy that used to go to the University of Wisconsin got in touch with one of his old people in his department. The person in the department was Bob Skloot, and the guy who visited was named Dick Chudnow. And he came to Madison and he said, hey, I've got this show in Milwaukee with actors and non-actors, and it's called Theater Sports, and it's this Canadian thing, and I want to see if anybody in your theater department wants to do it in Madison. And so after finding out about this, a few of us that were in that play were like, yeah, that sounds cool. And I was like, improv, I know what that is. I saw these other people do it.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't have me.
They didn't like me.
And so the first quote unquote audition that Dick and John Bank and Karen Kohlberg ran in Madison was Jeff Kramer and Teresa Lyons and Jay Indick and Lorraine Barr and David Miller and Leslie Hollander and Brian Capel, who were all part of the University of Wisconsin Theater Department as mm-hmm. either grad students or undergrads. And then Richard Wilgrubs and Jennifer Rupp, who eventually, I guess, married the boss.
Yeah.
And Pat Walsh and Brian Capel. Anyway, Dick just said to us, like, you're all great. So you are going to be the show. Like, it wasn't an audition anymore. It was just, you're going to be the show. And,
so you're like, eat that arc, huh?
Well, what happened was I had auditioned for the arc, for a third time, a few weeks before the first Theater Sports Madison workshop with Dick. And I auditioned for them. And after the first Theater Sports thing with Dick and Karen and John, he had said to us as we were all leaving the school, the classroom at the University of Wisconsin Humanities Building, he had said, you're all in. If you want to be in the show, you're all in the show. And so I went home, you know, walking on air. I was just very excited. And I got a phone call within like 24 hours from the ARC.
You did?
Saying, Yeah, from Elaine saying, we want you in our show. Do you want to be in our show? And I said, oh, there's this other show that's about to open called Theater Sports. Yeah. And would it be cool if I was in both? Could I be in both? And she said, absolutely not. You have to make a choice. And what? I talked to Dick the next workshop that we had a week later. And yeah. I said, hey, there's this other show. And he said, oh, yeah, I know. I've seen them. And I said, they want me to be in their show. And he said, oh, yeah, do both. Who cares? So I was like, all right, I'm going to do the Theater Sports thing because Dick was so nice and said, oh, you can do both.
Yeah.
And the other lady was not nice about it.
I wonder what that was about.
So it was weird. It was a weird thing because this was this group that I had revered. You know, I had seen them so many times. The only thing that I knew about improv was seeing these folks. And I thought they were the coolest thing. And then it's one thing to audition and not get in. It's another thing to then be asked to be in and then be told, well, you can't do the other show in town because it threatens us.
Right.
And Theater Sports didn't exist yet. I mean, it was just, in Madison, we were just workshopping. We hadn't opened our show yet.
Right.
So she was threatened by a phantom. Like she was threatened by this thing that she knew it was in town because she had heard about it through, you know, circles or she, I don't know how she knew about it, but she was just threatened by the idea that someone else would dare come into Madison and try to do an improv show, you know? So then we did workshops every week for 3 months, and Dick and Karen and John would come in every Sunday and we would hang out all day at the Midway Motor Lodge at the Hoffman House on the east side of Madison. And cause he had already struck a deal with them to do performances. And we would, you know, just do every game possible that Dick had picked up from Chris Keene, who had been doing Seattle Theater Sports. And we got really good. We got very slick and very skilled at about 10 old Theater Sports games. And then when we opened, we just did the same 10 games every show for months and months and months.
And what year are we talking right now?
Christine, this is where I have to reveal that I'm old enough to be most people's grandfather. But
you are not.
This was the summer of 85. So Milwaukee opened in October, I believe, of 84 at Colts in what was then known as the Indian Room. And so less than a year later, we opened in September of 85 in Madison.
Okay, and back to what are the 10 theater games? Can you remember what they were that you played over and over?
Well, we always opened with "What are you doing?"
Sure.
And then I think I'm going to get the order wrong.
That's okay.
Because other people have better memories than me. But we did "What are you doing?" Of course, our halftime break was always five things, and then we would do five things with an audience member to prove. I guess our honesty about it.
Right.
We would do what was called team choice and then team challenge, which meant that you could say to the other team, we challenge you to do Dr. Know-It-All, mm-hmm. Or arms behind expert, and storytelling. We always did storytelling every show, which in theater sports parlance was story to story die. Mm-hmm. We did in place. We eventually incorporated in place of five things. We would do what was called Chain Murders, but then we changed the name to Chain Murder Mystery.
Oh, I love that game!
It was also known as Chain Death Murders, which was so weird. So I guess the individual the games that you could challenge the other team to included stuff like replay or opera or what was called foreign expert or foreign translator, which are two different things.
Yeah.
Foreign movie was a thing.
Right.
So it was just a handful of what the Canadians call handles or what we would call games.
Okay.
And we just wore them out. you know, and it was, but it was great fun. Nobody in Madison had seen the kind of super fast, very, very high energy, version of improv, because even if you'd seen the Arc perform, they had a little more of a, I don't know how to describe it. It was a little, not slower might not be the right word, but a little more character-y, I guess, maybe, or something. And ours was a little more frenetic and fast paced and smart alecky, maybe, or something like that.
Smart alecky. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
So was this at the Hoffman House then for a couple of years?
No. We were only at the Hoffman House till Christmas. And then at the end of our 3 month relationship there, we knew that they weren't going to renew our contract. And mm-hmm. so a couple of us had gone to a nightclub because we were all, you know, everybody had their antenna open for the next place to perform.
Yeah.
And there was a famous nightclub in Madison called Bunkies, which was right on the corner of Park and Regent Street. For people who know Madison, it's right in the heart of, things, so to speak. And it was a famous music club in the 70s and the early 80s.
Oh.
And people like the Ramones played there and Elvis Costello and a bunch of bands had played there. And then later, when it had become a different thing and a different thing and a different thing after that,
right.
Nirvana played their last Madison gig there in 1990. But anyway, in 85, a guy had purchased that place, Bunkies, mm-hmm. and his name was Steve Zingsheim, and he called it Zingers. And he wanted it to be a stand-up comedy club. And so either Dick or Jennifer or the three of us went and met him and said, you know, we're doing this show on the East Side, you know, we'd love to find a different location. And he came to the show, and he and Dick were standing in the back of our final performance, which was probably between Thanksgiving and Christmas of 85.
Okay.
And at the end of the performance, he turned to Dick and said, "When can you start?"
Nice.
And then Dick told us all after the show, and we were like, "Yay, we have a new location." So we started there in January of 86, and that relationship lasted for about a year, maybe. But we were always in the hunt for a new location. And I was working at a place downtown called the Brat House, which was beer and brats.
Brats.
And a friend of mine was friends with the comedian Steve Marmel, a Wisconsin comedian who's gone on to reasonable fame and fortune and TV and stuff. And Steve Marmel was doing stand-up anywhere he could in Madison. And my friend who I worked with, Flipping Burgers, said, "Hey, Steve Marmel says that there's a cool room in the back of the Pizza Hut in right across the street on State Street." And I was like, "Really?" And I went in there, and I think Pat Walsh and I went in there and talked to the manager, and the manager said, "Yeah, we just do Super Bowl games, Super Bowl viewing parties in the back here." And I said, "Oh, we've got a comedy show we could do there."
Right.
And so Pizza Hut became our place from mid to late 86 until summer of 88. And that was the heyday of, you know, if there's a heyday of our early goings, that was it. Yeah. And then when Pizza Hut started to like want more money and kind of got annoying, you know, we were bringing in 500 to 600 people a week.
Nice.
To Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And they got weird to us, though. They got a little weird. And so we knew that there was a second floor to the Wendy's restaurant across the street, literally one did 661 State Street and 662 State Street.
Right.
And we knew that there was this giant unused second floor dining room at the Wendy's. And we went to one of the managers, who was really nice to us because we used to go and buy Frosties there and stuff. And And she said, "Oh my God, I would love to have your show here." And so when we ended our relationship with Pizza Hut, the next night after our last show at Pizza Hut, we did our first show at Wendy's, and that was our location for a couple of years after that.
Yeah, Comedy Sports Madison kind of bopped up and down State Street for a while. When I was there, we went to the West Side for a while, back to State Street. We're all over the place there.
Yeah, we opened, while I was still leading the circus, we opened at Upstairs Downstairs Deli at yes. Hilldale. Then we opened at Upstairs Downstairs Deli at State Street. Then yeah. we did shows at the Badger Bowl on the, off the freeway. And then eventually, Mark Malinsky and Brian Judkins, you know, found a place to rent and convinced, Dick and Jen that it was time to rent their own space.
Right. That was more like 96, maybe, like our own space there. How long were you?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. How long were you in Madison?
So I was there through the tumultuous years. Like we kind of skipped over this, Christine. We changed the name from Theater Sports to Comedy Sports. Dick had a kind of a tempestuous relationship, I think, with Loose Moose Theater, headquarters of Theater Sports in Canada, and he was like, "Look, I'm changing this, you know, enough, and you know, I'm going to change the name." And they were like, "You know, go with God, whatever." I think Keith Johnstone and Loose Moose just kind of rolled their eyes and just said, "You know, you do you, buddy."
Right.
And I never really had an in-depth conversation with Dick about that, you know, about, I think he just didn't like the name, honestly. I think he just didn't like the name Theater Sports and thought calling it Comedy Sports would have more of a, I don't know, have more of accessibility to it or something. But that was, you know, we were sort of naive. I mean, I think we all just did. We just didn't care. We were just like, whatever. We just want to do comedy shows. And so we kept on going. So in the, like, I guess spring of 89, I guess it was winter, spring of 89, a small sort of inner group, a small group of friends amongst the people at Madison Comedy Sports, we started to kind of get itchy about what we were going to do next with our life, with our career.
Yeah.
And so there, at the time, there were about 17 or 18, like the ensemble of Comedy Sports Madison was about 17 or 18 people. And many of us lived with each other or had day jobs with each other at restaurants and things like that. But there was a small group of like five of us who were really kind of itching to up the ante in our careers. And Josh Lewis said, "Look, I'm going to New York to be an actor." And I said, "Well, I'm thinking about Los Angeles or maybe Chicago or something like that." And I remember having a conversation with Dick and Jen, and I was thinking like, "Oh, I could open a Comedy Sports in Los Angeles." As soon as I said those words, suddenly James Bailey pops up and said, and you know, from, I hadn't known him, but suddenly James Bailey is like, "I've got a theater company in Los Angeles and I want to do a Comedy Sports show there." And I was like, "Oh, I guess he's got that."
Right.
So, but James had, West Coast Players. I think he might've been the artistic director of West Coast Players at the time. And he had been from Milwaukee and he knew Theater Sports and and Comedy Sports. And he thought it was the coolest thing. And, so then the conversation went like, "All right, if I visit Los Angeles, I'll go play Comedy Sports there. If I visit Chicago, there's a Comedy Sports there that Dave and Sue, I can't remember their last name right now, started, and Dave Gooday eventually took over.
Right.
But New York doesn't have a Comedy Sports." So I was like, that's where we're going to go. And so Josh and Mark Hervey and Graham Willoughby and Lee Becker and Dan Fleming and Dan Barrett and myself were all like, "Let's go to New York." So over the course of about a year and a half, we all moved to New York, and then we're eventually joined by Chris Tallman, and then eventually joined by Joy Garfield. And we became the New York Comedy Sports group.
Oh my God, my head is spinning, and we're only in 1989. I think you have so many awesome stories. How did you start then, well, yeah, like deciding, okay, we're going to go from Madison to New York and I'm just going to start a comedy sports in New York. I mean, New York, how did you do that?
Yeah. Well, there have been some things like some artistic high points in Madison, like David Adler, who had been part of the children's theater group, came on as our keyboardist. And then some guys that were in this crazy punk band in Madison called the Gomers became fans and joined theater sports. And then they became the comedy sports band. So we had this band, we had a live band at our shows. It was very much like David Letterman's band. And then Mary Parmentier became like the iconic referee after Jennifer left for Milwaukee, and Andy Wallman was sort of like the John Belushi of our show. And he had moved on to Michigan to do advertising. So there were these gigantic high points in those late 80s that kind of led to a group of us thinking, well, this show in Madison is going to keep going forever. So therefore we should help with the evolution of our own careers and go to New York. And, it was just a wing and a prayer. It was just like saying we're funny, you know, we're skilled, we're friends, we have an ensemble feel to us, and we're gonna go do this thing. And Madison is in good hands with, you know, there was a huge number of people that were in Madison that were awesome. And we were like, you know, this show will continue and we'll go to New York. So we get to New York. All of us sort of find ourselves there over the course, like I said, of about a year and a half, roughly. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of bicoastal, if you will, if Madison is a coast.
Well, it is on an isthmus, so.
Yeah, exactly. And I would go back to Madison and do the shows and maybe teach a workshop. The idea was that I was helping keep the Madison from business sense, not have bumps in the road while we were all moving to New York.
Yeah.
So I did that for a long time because I was going back anyway to hang out with my family. And in New York, we just pulled every string we had. We talked to every friend we had who was in any way, shape or form involved in the performing arts and also who worked at restaurants and bars.
Yeah.
And we found a party room in the back of a bar. And again, just walked around the streets of New York, handing out flyers, and started doing shows in the back of a bar called the Telephone Bar on Second Avenue in New York. And it was great. I mean, we got attention. It was magic. We got attention right away. We got written up in newspapers right away. And we had people from other groups coming right away. I should also say that after I had started telling people that my group, part of the Madison Comedy Sports group, was going to become a satellite and move to New York, I was telling people, and people be like, oh, that'd be great, you're gonna be great. And other people would say like, oh man, that's risky. Oh. I remember the guy that was in charge of all the Ronald McDonalds of the Midwest, AJ, who was a Milwaukee icon as, yeah, Ronald McDonald. He took me aside at a party, a comedy sports party in Milwaukee one time, and said, he looked at me like really seriously and said like, oh, you're taking your friends to New York. That's very dangerous there. You're going to be responsible for whatever happens. I'm not even giving you half of how dark he got with me just then, you know. He imitated getting stabbed and said, what? Like, one of these guys gets held up and that's going to be your responsibility, buddy. I hope you're ready for gray hair. It was really shocking, but wow. but we had a soft landing. You know, we had a lot of good friends that were in the NYU theater program, NYU film program, and so we just knew a lot of people. And when we opened, I think we had like, you know, we packed the room. We had standing room only in our first performance. I mean, the room was tiny. It only fit like 45 or 50 people, but you know, we knew we were going to be okay.
Yeah. Now, were there other improv troupes in New York at this time, or were you
Yes, there were groups that have been going on for 20, 25 years. There was a group called Chicago City Limits and Gotham City Improv and the Improvables, and every way that you can twist and turn the word improv or New York City into the name of a group there, that those groups were there. And, but many of them were super nice people and welcomed us, you know, wholeheartedly. They didn't, a lot of them bristled at the gimmick of the sort of baseball uniforms high energy, you know, frenetic aspect that was the Comedy Sports Show. They kind of bristled and said, like, come on, you know, just wear regular clothes and just, you know, go up and do scenes and be funny. And we were like, no, this is the way it goes, you know. but they were super nice. Most people that were in the established New York City improv scene were super nice to us and welcomed us to like tournament type things that they had and, you know, like jams and stuff like that. And they were really cool. I should say that before I had officially full on moved to New York, I started getting the New York Times in Madison.
Yeah.
And one day I had a phone message from, I've been teaching since the beginning of Theater Sports back in 85, I've been teaching workshops in improv and acting at the International Thespian Society, the Educational Theater Association. So I've got all these friends for many years and someone left me a phone message that said, congratulations on your move to New York. And I was like, wow. How did that guy from Utah, from some theater teacher from Utah, know that my group was going to move to New York? That's weird. And I was getting the New York Times and I opened up the New York Times that day. And he had included in his message, I saw it in the New York Times. And I was like, what? And I opened the New York Times, and on the front page of the arts section of the New York Times in like 89 or 90 or whatever it was, before I had fully moved to New York, I mean, I had an apartment there, but I hadn't cut all ties yet or whatever.
Yeah.
I opened the paper and there's a front page of the arts section article on New York theater sports. And there is a photo. Oh. And in the photo, there it's got these people in this funny position. They're doing like, you know, moving bodies or something like that.
Yeah.
And it said theater sports member Michael Rock does a game called, you know, mannequin bodies with an audience member at the recent theater sports show at the such and such theater.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was weird because it wasn't me. Because there was a theater company in New York called Freestyle Repertory Theater, who were the official New York City licensee of the Loose Moose Theater Company in Calgary to do theater sports. They had the regional license to do theater sports in New York City, and they were, and we didn't know it. We didn't know.
Oh, no.
We didn't know before moving to New York that there was already a group there called Theater Sports. That had the same origins that we did. That was the weirdest thing. And a guy named Michael Rock in the company there.
And another guy named Mike Rock.
So turns out that guy had gone to University of Pennsylvania with Jeff Kramer.
Oh.
And Jeff had told me about him years earlier. And I don't remember, by the way, right now, Christine, because of how memory is weird. Sure. I don't remember if when I looked at the New York Times, if I said to myself, oh, that's the guy that Jeff Kramer went to college with. I don't remember if I did that. Kudos to me if I did do that. But so we would, you know, doing the show and things were going great. We were getting written up in we were getting in all the listings, theater listings and comedy listings. And we started immediately within, you know, 10 minutes of arriving, we started writing comedy. And so we would do a comedy sports show. And at the end of the show, we'd do 10 minutes of sketch comedy. And that was the beginning of all of our, for the six or seven of us that first went there, that was sort of the beginning of all of our forays into professional acting and comedy and stuff.
And now is that scripted group? Is that what the Bert Furshners is?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we didn't have a name yet at the time, but yeah, that was what we were, what became the Bert Furshners back then.
And where did that name come from?
We were sitting around in a meeting, a writing meeting, and we were trying to come up with a name, and we were all tickled by the idea that Monty Python wasn't a person, but it sounded like a person. It sounded right. Like, oh, there's a person named Monty Python, and he's the impresario of this group. So we sort of came up with the idea of, oh, there's this person who's the impresario of our group. So that was kind of in the air, and I was on my phone about to leave my New York apartment to go do a comedy sports show. And I was on the phone with an improv friend in Vancouver named Richard Side.
Okay.
And he was from Vancouver Theater Sports. He was an awesome dude. And I should also say right now and interrupt myself yet again and say there is another Richard Side who also does improv, which is so weird. Talking to Richard Side, and I said, "Hey man, I gotta leave. I gotta hang up because it was a home phone, not a cell phone."
Right.
I said, "I gotta hang up. I gotta get on the subway because I gotta go do a theater sports show. By the way, or a comedy sports show. Tell me like a word or a phrase that I should include in the show in your honor tonight." And it was just sort of a thing that you do. Like sometimes you have a family member in the sure. audience, and you'll name a character the name of your family member who's right. in the audience visiting the show, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of do that for him because he was a bit of a improv hero for me. And I said, what word should I put in the show tonight? And he said, just make a reference to name a character, Mr. Ferschner. And I said, what? That's the weirdest thing. And I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and he laughed that I agreed or whatever. And I did that, and it got a laugh from the audience and the guys on stage. They thought after the show, they were like, God, what was that name you said? That was the weirdest name. And I said, I was on the phone with Richard Side in Vancouver, and he told me to say Mr. Ferschner. And we laughed and we thought it was hilarious. So then when we're trying to name our group, I just blurted out, what about Mr. Ferschner? The funny thing that, you know, that we've been using in the show, you know, the character. And so then somebody else said, there's gotta be an alliterative first name.
Yeah.
And, Mark, I think said, Bert. and then we changed it to Ferschner instead of Ferschner. And, that's where the name came from, but we never admitted that for many years. Every time we did an interview or talked to anybody at a comedy festival or something, yeah. we would make up our rule amongst ourselves. We had to make up a fake origin story for the name.
What was the best fake origin story? Do you remember?
I think that he was the first, before the Wright brothers, he was the first failed test pilot of a plane that actually got a plane up in the air, and nobody heard of him because he died or something like that.
Because he died, yeah.
There was also like, you know, professional bowling guy.
Nice.
You've only to go to your local public library microfiche and find old articles where we're mentioned, and you'll find a bunch of different origin stories. And then eventually people caught on because when they did research on us, they were like, I read a couple articles about you guys. And
that'll be my next episode. All the origins of Bert Ferschner.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So throughout your time in New York, why do you think, like right away you said your first show there was sold out and you were received really well. There were other improv groups already there established. What did comedy sports do to make themselves stand out?
Well, we weren't afraid to walk out on the sidewalk and the streets and hand out flyers for our show. Mm-hmm. We weren't afraid to call everybody we all knew and extended family and extended friends and tell them that we, you know, be bold and say like, hi, I live in New York now and I'm doing a comedy show. You should come and see it. We just had this attitude of shake all the trees, you know, tell everybody, you know, there's some old saying in advertising that you go to the highest peak and shout about your product until people start listening to you or something like that. I can't remember what it was. It's probably less eloquent than that. Cause I'm pretty sure that sounded pretty brilliant.
It really did. I'm writing it down.
Yeah. Go to the highest peak. That's it. Ding. Mad Men. So we literally, we printed postcards. Everybody in our group that knew the address of anybody in New York City, we started compiling a mailing list, and we would make postcards and just really told everybody, and we would drop off flyers or postcards or 2-for-1 passes or whatever at anywhere in New York that there was a pile of you know, cards about local theater or local comedy clubs or something, you know, bars, restaurants, just anywhere that there was like a little stack of grab this flyer as you're on your way out of this establishment, we would, in an unauthorized way, put ours there as well. And we were pretty relentless about press releases too. You know, we really wanted to get into the theater listings, and this all came from, and the comedy listings, this all came from the, we did the exact template in Madison, although Madison being a city of, you know, 250,000 at the time, and New York City being 8 million, it was a different game, a different animal, but we did the same template, you know.
That's what you had to do before the internet. I mean, it wasn't just social media. It was literally going out with postcards and posters and calling people and trying to get in newspapers. And, you know, I mean, it sounds
Yeah, this was a time when you had to understand that you were no longer, it wasn't a high school theater production where you knew that the school was going to take care of getting people to come to the show. It wasn't a college theater production where you knew that the reputation of the college theater department was going to cause people to come to the show. It wasn't a community theater production where, you know, that had like a status in the community where people come to the show. We were a professional comedy show in Madison and in Milwaukee and then in Madison and then in, you know, wherever else Comedy Sports opened up. And it was a thing where you had to figure out a way to generate your audience. And, you know, we had to be unabashed about walking up to strangers on the street and handing them a flyer. And that started in Madison. You know, we walked up and down State Street in Madison in our Comedy Sports uniforms, handing out flyers. So we did the same in New York.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And now it's just click a button, right?
Well, you know, yeah, that's absolutely true that social media has made it really easy to promote. But keep in mind, you know, social media has also made the fire hose of information coming at people pretty relentless. So
yeah, for sure.
It's the same game applies. You know, you still have to get your name and your show, whatever your show is, in front of people's eyes. But, you know, you also have to have a good show, and you also have to get people to talk about your show and try to get the press to talk about your show if it's possible, and cross-pollinate with other theater groups or other comedy groups and clubs and festivals. And I mean, it's all the same principles of how the word gets out apply. It's just maybe a little easier than walking up to strangers in Times Square and handing them a flyer for your show.
Right. Now, how long were you in New York doing Comedy Sports?
So we opened in August of 92, and then in like 99, 2000, a lot of people may not remember, well, old timers will remember this, but young timers won't remember this. There was a brief shining moment when Comedy Sports was about to maybe become like the Starbucks of comedy in the country, or the McDonald's or the Kmart or whatever you want to call it. Because this venture capitalist and his business partner were really interested in trying to do that. They wanted to have, you know, 100 Comedy Sports locations in every, you know, strip mall in the country. And they came in and struck a deal with Dick and Jen to do, like, you know, we're going to franchise Comedy Sports. You know, we're going to create a Bible, like Kentucky Fried Chicken has a Bible for their franchises, and, and create this thing. And it really sometime in 99, 2000, it really seemed like it could conceivably happen, but they kind of turned out to be not super people friendly people. And Dick was ever faithful and was like, look, we're going to make it happen. You know, he would come to, you know, we have these managers meetings at tournaments and things like that. And he would say, like, look, I know they're businessy people, but it's going to work. We're all going to benefit from this. It's going to be great, you know. And managers around the country started to become a little skeptical about these guys. And you know, there was this weird thing, because these guys were based in New York, or actually Connecticut. There was this weird thing that happened to me, not to sound like, oh, woe is me, but I think there was this perception from comedy sports managers around the country that I had some special relationship with these guys, when in fact I was really not digging them. They kept on saying to me, like, oh my God, your space, you know, we were in the back room of this really great bar in New York called the Telephone Bar, as I said. But it was a tiny little space. And they said to me, you got to close your show. Your show is, you guys are really funny and really talented. And by this time, I should say that Colton Dunn was in our show, and Victor Varnado and Eric Noble. We had a bunch of really funny people in our show. And we were having a great time. And the Bert Furchners existed, and we were doing shows elsewhere. And this guy came to our show and told us, you're too good for this venue. You got to close your show. And we were like, what?
What?
So then it wasn't asking anymore. And he actually closed our show. I mean, he said, I own the rights to Comedy Sports. You know, I have a deal with Dick and Jen, and I can say where Comedy Sports can be. So he was promising us he was going to find us this amazing new venue, and then that was going to be the crown jewel and the beginning of the new revolution of comedy sports around the country. And I told him no. I said, I'm not going to work for you. And Dick was like, don't worry, it's going to work out. You know, we're going to figure something out. And I said, dude, I can't work with that guy.
Yeah.
And then I just said, you know, I have to not deal with this anymore. So I stopped talking to that guy and I told Dick, you know, he's pressured me to close our show. And it ended badly. So we closed, I think in the spring of 2000, and then, within, I don't know, a year or so, Jill Sheely and Dan Fleming, got the urge to restart it and managed to launch it again. But by then I had already started traveling to Los Angeles to try to start a new career out here. So I wasn't going to be part of the New York scene anymore. And the Bert Furchners were no longer. So it was time to move on. But yeah, but between 92 and early 2000 was our reign of terror in the East Village of New York City. And it was great. It was so much fun.
So this guy just randomly says you're closed, and that's why New York Comedy Sports closed in that time?
Well, he didn't just say you're closed. He said, your venue is embarrassing. We're going to build you we're going to find a great new place, and it's going to be amazing and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And every time that, you know, I'd sit down with the crew, with our group at the time, which was, you know, Dan, as I said, and Jill and Todd Wilkerson and Mary Denmead and Colton Dunn and Eric Noble and Victor and Josh Lewis and all the guys that had started it. And every time they would say, like, what's the update with these guys? I'd say like, well, you know, they're promising us they're going to find a new venue, and it wouldn't happen.
Eventually
they said, you know, first step, the venture capitalist guy, would say the first step is to close that space, not perform in that space anymore. And you have to suspend your performances for, I think he even made it, maybe said it was a temporary thing. And you have to suspend your performances until we can find you a more suitable venue for the name. Cause his deal was, he believed that he was investing an amount of money on the possibility that this venture of a nationwide, you know, comedy sports thing, in 100 places or something. He thought that if money was going to come from anywhere, New York City was a pretty good chance, a pretty good opportunity to showcase what it was. And he would have been, in his words, embarrassed to bring somebody to the place where we did our show.
Wow.
So that's why he insisted that, yeah, because I think his point at the time was, I've invested some money to try to make this happen. I don't want to say to someone, the thing I'm trying to get you interested in is called comedy sports, and have that person stumble upon your rinky dink little operation in the East Village. And then, you know, say to me like, no chance, this is just some back of a bar kind of a thing.
Wow. So now, at this point, what's your goal for you, Mike Rock? You've done comedy sports for this long, and you've been in New York, and now you said you want to go to L.A. What's your goal?
I wanted to
like TV,
have a career in acting. I mean, I had been doing lots of commercials and voiceovers, and the Bert Furtners had done some television. We had, you know, we had a few different deals in television that gave us a taste of it.
Yeah.
And you know, we knew that Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub and Peter Alberts had taken Scud to LA and had started having some success there. And by then, by 2000, oh my God, I mean, they all had careers. Chris Tallman had I think by then had already moved to LA and started working, and Kurt Scholler and a whole bunch of Wisconsin friends of ours had moved to LA and had careers, you know, either in screenwriting or in television or in commercials and it just seemed like to me personally, I was like, what am I waiting for? I mean, it just felt like the right thing to do. But you know, in my own personal style of torturing myself, I again chose to have one foot on both coasts for a few years before finally settling one place.
Before you committed to LA?
I mean, I was mentally committed, but I guess I wasn't physically committed until I got a pretty decent job out here.
So now, did you do comedy sports in LA? Like, did you go to James Bailey and start performing there?
No, I got to LA and it just didn't seem like to me, like I know that even earlier than that, a lot of people that were doing comedy sports in one city would uproot and move to another city. A lot of people fell in love with somebody from another city and then would move there et cetera, or just wanted to expand their horizons. And the fact that a comedy sports existed in another city was of great appeal, which is great and wonderful. And I supported it and thought it was awesome. I mean, we welcomed a bunch of, like I said, a bunch of Minneapolis folks and had a great time, et cetera. But for me, I kind of thought to myself, you know, I'm an actor. I had gone deep into acting school by then. I'd rediscovered what you'd call traditional acting or traditional acting training or something by the late 90s, early 2000s. And so I started studying in professional acting programs and thought to myself, you know, I'm gonna go to LA and do acting. And it was weird. I know that probably had I knocked really hard on the door at Comedy Sports they probably would have, you know, said, come on, do shows. Yeah. But I didn't. I think I remember at one point James saying like, hey, if you want a place to work out, you know, we do our main company rehearsals on Wednesday nights or whatever it was. And you're welcome to come and, you know, use the gym. But it took a couple of years before I started doing shows there, and I didn't do comedy sports shows there. I did other shows there. Matt Young and Andy Goldblatt had a show called The High that was a teen, long form teen soap opera, and then later the Downton Abbey spinoff improv show that we did, it was called Manor House Manor. But you know, it just didn't seem like acting or career, not career. That sounds kind of crass. It didn't seem like acting or comedy progress for me to do comedy sports. It felt like it felt a little maybe convenient and not necessarily goal oriented for what I was trying to do with who I am on stage, I guess is the best way to put it.
Right.
I felt like, oh, I'm, you know, like to use a terrible analogy, I felt like, oh, I'm a good skier. I could go on the you know, I could go to all of my favorite ski places, or I could go to a new ski place and see what that's like and see what that challenge is about. And that's kind of what it was. It was more like, you know, a different focus on acting. So I studied acting. I didn't do like, you know, like I didn't do like the Groundlings or Improv Olympic or UCB or anything that was established in LA when I got here. I didn't want to do improv comedy. I wanted to be an actor.
So how did Comedy Sports prepare you for that, though, for LA? How did it prepare you to become an actor?
Well, it's funny because having been an actor kid when I was really young, mm-hmm. I had the inclination and or aptitude or whatever that is from when I was a child. And it was more like whatever I was exposed to, I was going to try and see how it worked. And so Comedy Sports was just a thing that, or rather the arc was a thing that I saw and thought, oh, I could do improv comedy. And then when Theater Sports, when Dick brought Theater Sports to Madison and then it became Comedy Sports, et cetera, it was just the thing that seemed like the most apt, expression of who I was. It just so happens that as circumstances went, I became in charge of it. I mean, Dick and Jen are going to go to Milwaukee. Jen's going to move to Milwaukee and Pat Walsh moved to Washington, D.C. And, you know, everybody's leaving me. I guess I'm in charge now. So it took over my life. Doing the comedy part of Comedy Sports was fantastic. Doing the business side was sort of like a great way to make a living. And the fact that I could quit my restaurant job was great, but it really did take over. It really didn't let me pursue a career in acting. And I was fine with that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then after we moved to New York, it was not able to make my living anymore because, you know, New York, you'd have to be a hit off Broadway show or Broadway show to make a living in New York running, a theater group or a comedy group, or you'd have to use the Second City model and start a school and have the school actually make your living. But we didn't do that. So I had this itch as an actor, as a performing artist, as a creator, that wasn't being scratched because there wasn't time. I didn't have time being the business person. I didn't have time to, you know, pursue other things. And, in terms of Comedy Sports preparing me, it taught me how to get on stage anywhere, anytime, with anybody, in front of anyone, and create something instantaneously such that you could completely adaptable to almost any circumstances. Now, there were some circumstances where, you know, even the best plans for a comedy show go awry, you know, when you have a giant venue with terrible lighting and sound and the audience can't see or hear you, then the show isn't going to go that great. Right. But Comedy Sports was this amazing, sort of the format of Theater Sports then Comedy Sports was this thing that an audience with a limited attention span, you know, like eating and drinking, they could still get the show. Now, in some Comedy Sports cities, when they first launched, they wanted to be more like a proper theater, like, you know, Los Angeles in particular, when they built mm-hmm. their first space, it's a theater. It's not there's no tables for food and drink. Right. It's like, you know, you're at a theater watching a show. Yeah. So some of the cities wanted their show to be more like that. But other cities kind of took that template that we had in the early days for food and drink and stuff. So that causes you as a performer on stage to sort of respect and adapt to that kind of like on again, off again, attention span of the audience. And as an actor, when you walk into auditions or when you are doing some sort of a showcase event or something, if you're prepared as an improviser and you're doing scripted work, you're kind of ready for anything that happens in terms of like the words and the action on stage. But if you're prepared as a seasoned comedy sports or theater sports person who's done shows in clubs and shows at bars and fraternities and sororities and, you know, holiday parties for law firms and stuff. You're not just prepared from an improv standpoint for what happens in the performance. You're also prepared from an audience interaction and the energy in the room standpoint. And this point that I'm in the middle of making is so completely overlooked by so many people. Every casting office and, you know, TV and film production in the world says, oh, it'd be great if our actors had improv experience. And they think that they mean, you know, you're kind of like flexible with the way you react, even though you're still saying the same words because the thing is scripted. And in some cases, of course, when they say improv experience, they mean we literally want you to make some stuff up in addition to what's written. Sure. But what people miss that only happens with a lot of experience doing shows where the audience isn't giving you 100% of their attention all the time, what people miss is you become really flexible and really adaptive to getting people's attention, holding people's attention,
being willing, not being hurt
or distracted by the fact that there's a push and pull and a give and take going on with the what's going on stage and what's going on in the audience. So, to use a terrible analogy, a stand-up comedian like Milwaukee's own Tom Clark can talk directly to the audience and say, "Hey, buddy, hey, I see you're enjoying your French fries. Did you know I just told a joke or whatever?" In a comedy sports show, you don't really do that. I mean, sometimes we did, but you don't really do that kind of thing. But you are adapting every moment. You're kind of like being flexible and adapting to the energy of the room. And that, I think, is the greatest lesson that a show, you know, a show like comedy sports teaches. This is in addition to just the relationship that you can have with another performer and the mind meld, one brain kind of a thing that you can have with your teammates on stage. That of course, that's, I'm kind of assuming that that's sort of a given that everybody knows that about improv and about comedy sports or theater sports or something. It's that ability to be on stage and anticipate what the other person might say or do and make them an offer and being willing to adapt to whatever they say or do. To me, that's sort of a given if you're going to study improv. But it's that quick ability to be ready for anything when you're performing that I think is a gigantic asset for a performer that you get from doing comedy sports shows
or
theater
sure.
sports shows.
Now, how did you approach or how do you continue to approach character work and character development when you're doing a scene?
I started to kind of realize like, oh, there's sort of a rich benefit to walking on stage and having as a top priority developing a very specific character, like developing a person that has very specific wants and needs, status, condition, et cetera, in relationship to the other characters as early as possible in a show, as a kind of an offer. To make those choices for yourself is an offer to the rest of the ensemble. And I learned that, from doing these other shows, doing these quote unquote long form shows. And it was a huge gift because when you're doing script, I'd been doing scripted work for so long by this point that I had kind of lost the spontaneity or instantaneity of improv. And this was kind of a different approach. This was saying like, all right, we're not going to do a Herald where we just kind of revisit scenes and see them blend and then break apart and then blend differently and et cetera. But we're going to do a narrative, and we're going to do scenes that kind of overlap and intermingle and et cetera. But we're going to create distinct characters that exist throughout the narrative. And I was like, oh man, that's such a cool approach. And it had been going on, you know, without me sort of realizing it for a while at a lot of places that were doing improv and trying different forms. But I just wasn't really doing improv for a few years. I want to say probably like 6, 7 or 8 years, I wasn't really doing improv very much. A tiny bit here and there, but really not that much. And certainly most of the shows I would guest, you know, I would jump in and guest with Houseful Honkies and some other groups.
That's, what did you just say?
Wayne Brady and Jonathan Mangan and okay. Joel McCrary and Claire Sarah and Matt Young. But when I would guest with different groups and stuff, I wouldn't be thinking like develop a character, blah, blah, blah. I would just be thinking, have fun, be funny, enjoy, connect to the other performers. But then I started seeing more shows from this group called Impro Theater, which was the original LA theater sports group. And the Bert Frischners had met the LA theater sports people back in like 88 or something at the Big Stinkin' Improv Festival in Austin, Texas. And we thought they were cool. We were like, you guys are funny. We're not doing theater sports. Our show is called Comedy Sports, whatever it was. But we thought they were nice. They were cool. We loved watching their show. And that was it. And then a few years later, I sort of realized, oh my gosh, all those guys that used to be LA theater sports are now called Impro, and they are doing full length plays. Improvised fully plays. And I was like, oh, that is the coolest thing. And I've met those people. I know those people. Met those people. And they know all my friends. So I started going to their shows, and they knew everybody I knew from Comedy Sports. And some of them had, when they first arrived to LA, did Comedy Sports and stuff. But now they were doing this thing. They had stopped doing theater sports shows and they were doing full length plays. And I watched them and I realized, oh, this is that character thing. You know, I was like, this is that thing where when you're improvising like a thing that's not games, but is instead a narrative. The most successful performances that I saw were when the audience could identify distinct characters. Mm-hmm. And they were doing it better than anybody. They were doing it better than anybody had ever seen before. And I just was like, oh man. And then I realized what it was. It was the alchemy of people who've been doing improv for a long time together, but who were also skilled actors and directors and writers, so that they could tease apart the idea of creating a full-length narrative on their feet with one another. And at any given moment in each of these performers' brains, they were being a director for a second, or they were being a writer for a second, but then they were being an actor for a second. It was just like this amazing ability. And I realized, oh, they're creating these characters as quickly and definitively as they can early in the performance, and then the relationships come from how distinct the characters are with their points of view and their opinions about each other and et cetera as they endow each other. And then out of those relationships is the story. They're not telling a narrative timeline so much as they're telling the story of who these characters are and what their relationships are. And out of that comes the interesting, compelling narrative that I want to watch. Like, I don't care whether or not they succeed in robbing the bank. I care about how the process of trying to rob the bank affects each of these characters and their relationships with each other. And when I saw more and more of those shows, I was like, this is what I need to be doing.
Yeah.
And it was like a redo of the same instinct I had, you know, many years earlier when I first saw The Ark back, you know, when I was in high school. I had that same feeling of like, oh, that's terrifying. I want to do that. And so I just started getting involved. I've made it known that I had met many of them before, and they're like, yeah, we know, you know, like,
yeah.
And then just started hanging out and, started doing shows with them. And, so yeah, that's the long answer.
So somewhere along the way at Comedy Sports, did you have a nickname?
Early on, so in the early Milwaukee days, a Dick would put in the program, he would make up nicknames, and sometimes people would make up their own nicknames.
Right.
And so when he came to Madison, he said, look, everybody has to, you have to have a nickname. We're going to put it in the program. And then when Mr. Voice announces you before the show, they'll say your nickname. And, Dick wanted my nickname to be, hold on a second. Oh, I'll think of it. But I didn't like it. I didn't like what Dick gave me. And I said to him, like, dude, I don't want that. I don't. And he kind of like, oh, come on. Oh, I wish I could remember what it was. Anyway, I will remember because he printed it in one of the early programs. And I'm sure I've got one of those in a file. Sure. But I changed it to Rolling, as in the beer Rolling Rock. So Mike Rolling Rock.
Okay.
But Mark Malnitsky, ladies and gentlemen, became such an expert at giving people nicknames.
He gave me mine.
People would ask him. They would say, "Mark, make me a nickname. Make me a nickname." I should also say, Christina, I would be remiss to not mention that in that University of Wisconsin graduate theater program at the time, the directing department at the time was one Mike Mankey, and Mike Mankey did not want to be a theater sports performer on stage at the time, but I looked at him. We also worked at the Brathouse Bar together. And I looked at him one time and I said, dude, come with me across the street to Pizza Hut tonight. I'm going to put a microphone in your hand and you're going to be the announcer guy for our show tonight. And he was like, what? And I said, you're going to do it. It's going to be great. So not only did I convince Mike Mankey to come and be the announcer voice, of which he became iconic, but then he eventually became an onstage performer. I don't think for very long, but he did that for a while. And then, of course, Mike Mankey became the voice of the University of Wisconsin Badgers basketball, hockey, and football. but yeah, so hearing Mike Mankey's resonant baritone announce your name and your nickname, and then eventually later Mark Malnitsky doing the same,
right,
was a joy,
yeah,
to hear, you know. And of course, I should also mention that one of the greatest nicknames in the history of Comedy Sports nicknames was for Sheila Haynes, because at the time there was, it's misspelled differently, but there was a commercial campaign for Haynes underwear on television that was ubiquitous, that said, they don't say Haynes until we say they say Haynes. And Mark Malnitsky one night said, Sheila, they don't say Haynes until we say Haynes, Haynes.
That's awesome.
That is a quality nickname right there.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up, although I don't want to. Maybe you'll come back for a second interview sometime. I would love to continue
anytime
to talk to you. I'm going to do a quick couple like lightning round questions for you. Okay, so real quick, whatever comes to your head first. Bert or Ernie? Who do you prefer?
Bert.
Favorite food?
Pizza.
Pizza? All right, what's favorite topping?
I'm one of those weird people who's gluten free and vegan.
Oh,
so,
no.
It's like, I'll go controversial and say pineapple so people can be upset about that.
All right. All right. Favorite comedian that you always looked up to?
George Carlin.
Nice. All right. All right. Favorite movie?
Jaws.
Favorite Golden Girl?
B. Arthur.
Okay. All right. Three's Company, Chrissy, Cindy, or Terry?
The OG, Chrissy, come on.
Yeah. Ropers or Furley?
Furley, just because of Don Knotts.
Did you ever get to meet one of your idols that you got to look up to in comedy?
I have met some of my idols. Yeah. Yeah.
Name drop something.
In some cases, it was great. In other cases, it wasn't super great.
Can you name drop somebody? Tell me someone that you got to meet.
I've met three pythons.
Really?
I met Michael Palin in New York City. I met John Cleese at Chelsea lately, and I actually had dinner with Eric Idle because our own Jeff Davis is good pals with Eric, and I went and had dinner with them one night.
Awesome! Wow. And our final question of the night or the day, wherever you're listening here, my favorite listeners, would you rather lick a hot iron or eat a handful of red ants?
Red ants.
Really? I was going for the iron.
No, red ants. Listen, ants have a good deal of antium in them, and antium is that's an element that people just don't get enough of. It's very difficult to get enough antium in your diet. So eat a handful of red ants. I mean, it depends on how big the hand is. But if you eat a handful of red ants, you've got antium for probably weeks or even months at a time. So, you're good. Hot iron, that would hurt your tongue if you licked a hot iron. It would probably burn.
Red ants would, bite you and your tongue with the, ew, real? Okay, all right. Well, you know, you learned something new.
Just depends on how fast you chew, Christine.
Mike Rock, I can't believe I finally got to talk to you today. This has been fantastic.
Christine, it has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you, listeners, for listening.
Mike Rock, everybody, thanks so much. The Comedy Sports Podcast is produced and engineered by Kyle Hannikin. Our announcer is PJ Rockwell. Feel free to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram. Comments and inquiries can be sent to thecomedysportspodcast@gmail.com. Created and hosted by me, Christine Rolo Capriolo. Catch you next time.
The Comedy Sports Podcast is an independent production made by CSC Players. The views and opinions expressed by the podcast host and any guests are their own and do not represent the views and opinions of any CSE location or CSE worldwide. Vocabulary used by the host and guests is not necessarily representative of the CSE brand.